passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And here we are with the June 26th edition of Pollock and Thurston. I am John Pollock reporting to you from Toronto while Brandon Thurston is live at the scene of tonight's double taping at the KeyBank Center as AEW presents Dynamite, immediately followed by Collision going into Forbidden Door. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? I'm not at the KeyBank Center right now, no. Actually, to be fully transparent here. But I'm probably going to go there later, though. Probably.
Brandon Thurston could be making his second appearance at Dynamite.
I hope not on screen. No.
No, I don't think you're going to be identified on screen. That would be my safe assumption. But that is coming up tonight, where they will be in Buffalo. And with a pay-per-view coming up on Sunday, that means that Tony Khan will be doing a media call on Thursday. And have you given any thought to whether Thursday afternoon will produce a breaking news ratings reaction piece from Brandon Thurston, whether it be audio, written, or otherwise? And what have your online messages been like since last Thursday?
Well, the call is at like 1 something, right? The media call. So the rating will come out, the Dynamite rating will come out after that. I would predict a normal rating, not like last week's rating, but more like the ratings in the weeks before last week, and it being sort of back to normal. So I don't think that will justify any emergency breaking news ratings analysis.
Okay. They are going up against, what is it? The NBA draft is tonight, I think.
Is that tonight?
I'd have to double check.
I'll look. I know. But my messages, yes, I have received, including from John Pollock, I received messages immediately about the rating when the rating came out on Thursday afternoon. But I made sure to confirm in the original report, this is not an error. I have confirmed independently that this is not an error. 0.16, what was it, 502,000 viewers.
Mm-hmm. I would think that the reasonable expectation is that there will be a bounce back this week, and then we will have a whole discourse about all the thoughts on the sky falling last week. I did think last week was a noteworthy number to at least digest and ask the reasons as to why. And you can probably come up with a lot of different reasons. It was certainly a heavily analyzed figure. And
what are your
to me,
reasons?
I think you can, if you want to bring up the various issues from, you know, the wrestling killer himself, Kendrick Lamar. There was the Juneteenth holiday. There was the Black Panther lead-in. Like all these things, like I can take to a degree. But to me, the fall was so low that this year they had not fallen below a 0.23. And to drop to such a level, I don't know. I just can't look at all of those different factors as producing like the all-time lowest 18 to 49 audience when this is an episode of a show that is aired on countless Thanksgiving Eves and was on the night of January 6th, where people were inundated with news coverage. Like they've gone against all this stuff in the past. So, I mean, maybe it bounces right back up and you still have, I think, more concerning. It's like just the trends of attendance. And that's not a 1 week blip. That's been a long standing issue that, you know, does give relevance to the popularity decrease that AEW has experienced. It was just, this was one of those numbers that certainly catches you by attention, but it's not as though this is the end of Warner Brothers Discovery's interest in professional wrestling, but it's,
yeah, no, still, I think their TV outlook is fine, barring another similar number this coming tonight. Do you think that there's any introspection at the highest levels of AEW about why their popularity level is what it is, or is there an acceptance that the popularity is not what it was a year ago or 2 years ago? Is that a meaningful thing? Do you think it's even a meaningful difference?
I am certain that the message will be a very positive one on the media call on Thursday. But I think if you were to speak to those people in positions to be analyzing these figures, I mean, you can't help but look at where they have dropped to and an understanding that at the very least to concede, we are in a transitional period for AEW. And it's tough because I think that this shift that they are making, like television ratings, you're so like it just breeds reactionary measures and not having patience in a vision trying to play itself out and where we're going to be. I think that the programming has been very strong these last couple of weeks. But you're also in this contract year at the moment where you don't want to be necessarily, it can certainly intensify the need to just do something, you know, to hotshot an idea that is going to generate a 1 week buzz for a number. But to your question, I think you would have to look at just all these different metrics and understand that, yeah, there's a decrease in popularity. And some of it is, to a degree, out of their control when you're talking about what the resurgence of WWE and like, is it a combination? Is AEW turning off its audience, or is simply that audience they're being satisfied through many hours of WWE programming? And this is the realistic amount that they are dedicating to AEW now on a weekly basis. It's not necessarily an indictment of AEW programming. It's a reality of the landscape that's very different from 2019 and 2020.
And from a brand perspective, a content perspective, when WWE becomes more popular, does that change what the AEW brand is supposed to be about? Should there be some sort of creative strategy that's reconsidered and reapplied after the company that you had to be an alternative to is not in such a need anymore for an alternative because the people that it used to turn off, it's turning back on?
I think it's always important to be trying to present something to the market that the audience is not getting in great amounts elsewhere. So without question,
what will that consist of at this point for AEW?
Well, I think that there's aspects of WWE programming that are, you know, they're presenting a lot of more kind of in-depth characters now. We don't get the same complaints about the promos in WWE being like these scripts that have no life behind them. Like all these things have shifted in a great amount. AEW, they have this unbelievable roster. I don't know if like great wrestling matches has ever meant less to the fan that is so, they get such a healthy amount of wrestling across the board, no matter what wrestling you're watching. Great matches they're almost disposable now. They're expected on such a routine basis that I feel for the AEW product, I would want to be leaning a bit more on, you know, fleshing out some of these characters, getting, you know, not just your bell to bell performances, but having some of these, great talkers that you have in your company that can at least give some counterbalance within your programming as well. Like allowing an MJF, is he more valuable in a 10-minute promo segment versus a 15-minute commercial-free match with Rouge, for instance? It's not an easy question to answer because, WWE is, they're hitting on a lot of cylinders, but you clearly do see a fan base too that are kind of in the middle where they are like, I just listened to you with Jesse Callings, and Jesse like echoes the fact that just like the WWE product does not communicate to his tastes. And I don't think he's alone in that sense, that for a lot of people, they want a company that is not WWE. And with AEW, it becomes an easy trap to fall into where you fall on a lot of the patterns of WWE. And I think that's where the AEW fan base gets a little uneasy when they see elements of what they perceive as WWE creeping into their AEW programming.
Yeah, I think it's from a match quality standpoint, the AEW diehards absolutely prefer the match quality that they get to the match quality that's offered by WWE. That aside, I think there's enough great matches in AEW, but maybe what there's not are a one or two or three really well-defined top stars in AEW who are the major stars who are carrying the narrative, the creative narrative of that company, and who's really important to watch. I think there's maybe more than anything, that is the issue, especially after in 2022, you lost Cody. In 2023, you lost CM Punk, who are now two of the biggest stars for WWE. It's no coincidence. And that you have, MJF is probably one of them, but it's not as well defined as it could be in terms of top stars. And I think back to that 2015 downturn in WWE's business where we all sort of said, well, why is it down? Is it just the cord cutting? And the coincidence was that John Cena stopped being a full-time performer around then. What makes a business go up and down? It's big stars, actually, I think.
And I think that's a key, is that, they have this incredible roster, and I'm not even stating like you have to cut down the roster, but the idea of, okay, for the next, what we have are say 2 to 3 guys that we are building everything around. I think you put MJF into that bucket. I think you would,
Billy Gunn.
Of course. I mean, 1A, 1B on your star power list. And then like your next to me are the 4 people that over this next year, we are going to get hopefully 2 of those 4 are going to join that elite class at the top. And you can easily ask people, who are your top stars in AEW? And boom, they know who they are. And importantly, I think you also have an idea that the core people are going to be on your shows each week. A perfect example is like tonight, you have 2 episodes in Buffalo. And for weeks, you've been promoting Daniel Garcia and this chase after Will Ospreay. And here we are for this episode, and Daniel Garcia is going to appear on Dynamite, and then he's doing a match with the Butcher on Collision. And I look at this as somebody that, once you're dangling this match with a Will Ospreay, for a fan in Buffalo, you didn't know up until yesterday what this guy was even doing on the program. And I think you can also look at just things that you are teasing for people and building things for certain markets, building for television events beyond just everything peaking for the pay-per-view. And it's not to say they don't do that. You have your blood and guts, you have television events, but at this juncture for them, I would be peaking certain programs to pay off on television and not just have these marathon pay-per-views where that's the sole direction for all your programs to peak at.
Yeah. And I would suggest that the qualities that are needed to remedy some of their issues right now are things like discipline and focus and long-term planning, not just in terms of storylines, but in terms of elevating stars. And I see a pattern in AEW of not being able to apply that sort of discipline towards elevating stars over time.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana,
where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Coming up today on the show, we should tee up what is happening. Wait, that's it. AEW's problems were just erased in the last 14 minutes. That's what you get on Pollock and Thurston. David Bixenspan is going to join us. He's going to explain how WCW went out of business. He doesn't need four episodes to do it. He's going to do it in about 15 minutes. He will join us. We're going to chat about the end of Who Killed WCW, the passing of Jamie Kellner, several other WCW-related topics. And momentarily, we are going to be joined by Mickey Shuey of the Indiana Business Journal, and he's going to be chatting about a pretty sizable deal that WWE has closed with the Indiana Sports Corp. This was first reported by WrestleVotes on X last week, and then Mickey did some further reporting for it last week, and then on Monday, in advance of Raw in Indianapolis, they announced this deal that will be going multiple years, reportedly, by Mickey, to be about 7 years, and this will include next year's Royal Rumble, a future two-night WrestleMania event, and a two-night SummerSlam event. So Indiana, they're getting a ton of WWE content over the next several years.
And that Minneapolis SummerSlam in 2026? Is it 26 or 25? It's 26, isn't it?
Yes, 26.
Tells you this is not going to be a one-off in that Minnesota 2 years from now. That SummerSlam is going to be something that they're going to continue to market as a two-day event.
Well, here to speak about this big deal is Mickey Shuey of the Indiana Business Journal. And Mickey, thanks a lot for stopping by. We've been discussing this deal that WWE officially rolled out on Monday. And tell me a little bit about, first of all, the Indiana Sports Corp and its role in this entire deal and what its objectives are for those that are kind of curious about this relationship.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. So the Indiana Sports Corp was founded in 1979. It's actually the first local sports commission, which basically oversees bringing in big events like the Final Four, the College Football Playoff National Championship, and multitudes of other events every year. It was involved in bringing in the All-Star Game for the NBA. But they really were the local spearhead for bringing WWE here to Indianapolis. In fact, the president of the Indiana Sports Corp is Patrick Talty, who, if that name sounds familiar to anybody, who might listen to your show, he was the head of live events for WWE from 2012 to 2015, where he essentially oversaw a lot of these events that Indianapolis is going to be bringing in. They've been working on, Indiana has been working on bringing WWE events here for years, going back to, really since the 92 WrestleMania and then 2008 SummerSlam. But the last big effort came in 2018 when they were approached actually by WWE to bring to bid on WrestleMania, ended up not going anywhere, but since then there's kind of been this hankering to go after that and other wrestling properties again.
And Mickey, can you just detail for our audience what the details are that we know about this deal? Is it a 7-year deal and it's for a future, we don't know when, WrestleMania, SummerSlam and Royal Rumble on February 1st next year, correct?
Right. So it's an 8-year deal. They announced on Monday that it's an 8-year deal, and it does include those three events. And as you mentioned, SummerSlam and WrestleMania don't have set dates yet. As you were just discussing, there's some kind of fluctuation in the calendar right now about where could it fit in I know Nashville's possibly going to get WrestleMania at some point soon. Perhaps just as importantly as an entry point for wrestling fans to these events is Indianapolis and then other cities like Fort Wayne and Evansville will also get a get an opportunity to host other pay-per-view and kind of weekly events throughout the course of this deal. So Monday Night Raw was just in Indianapolis on Monday night. So more of those events, more SmackDown, more Fastlane type events will be coming to Indiana throughout the life of this deal, giving more opportunities, according to WWE, to serve as an entry point for newer wrestling fans, for wrestling fans who have never been to a live event, to kind of get excited about these larger events that are coming up.
And we don't have an idea yet of what the dollar figures are that are being exchanged for this?
At this point, we don't. We do know that WWE is getting a portion of a bid fund that Indiana actually created back in 2022. It was just funded during the last budget cycle by the state. That $10 million bid fund, a portion of that is going to the WWE. Unfortunately, though, those numbers aren't out there yet, and they have not been willing to discuss the finances because, you know, these deals, they're less inclined to focus on the finances than they are the flashy numbers like economic impact and other kind of highlights of these deals.
Yes, we're well aware of how secretive they can be. Yes.
It will be very interesting to see the spacing of, in particular, the major shows, starting with the Royal Rumble next year. I know in April 2026, you can correct me if I'm wrong, the men's NCAA tournament will be at Lucas Oil Stadium in April 2026. Do you think that would likely rule out 2026 of having too close of an event? And as well, you want to probably space these out with the idea of tourists that are going to be coming back to Indianapolis on top of it.
Right. I actually was looking at the calendar today for that very reason, because I was like, wait, we have a Final Four coming up. When is that? And as you mentioned, 2026, if they were to stack those, it would be a very busy month for the stadium staff at Lucas Oil Stadium. But it's not unprecedented. They've done concerts one night and then Colts games one or two nights later. So they know how to turn around the venue for big events. The question is, how much time does NCAA need to move out, which is typically about, from what I recall, about 3 to 6 days to pack up everything. And then how much time does it take for for one of these events, WrestleMania, particular, to move in, because there's a lot of that additional lighting, there's a lot of banners and a lot of stages that have to be set up. So I think that it would make it less likely that 2026 is where they end up with WrestleMania, but I don't think that it's out of the question at this point from the way Lucas Oil Stadium has proved itself to be able to operate.
And in the press release that they put out on Monday morning, they say that the combined economic impact of WrestleMania, SummerSlam, and Royal Rumble is $300 million. We could probably speculate, but do you have any ideas how they're coming to that number? I assume it's a lot of hotels and local business impact.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we don't have a breakdown of those events individually at this point in time. I requested that from the Sports Corp, but I've not gotten that figure back yet, but certainly they're taking into account the hotels. They're taking into account the spending at restaurants, downtown restaurants, and other entertainment venues that might be downtown. And then from what I've gathered from previous WrestleMania events in particular, that event, I know, spurs a lot of other wrestling activity throughout the host city over the course of that week. So I'm guessing they're probably folding that in some way, just an assumption about how much ancillary how many ancillary shows there's going to be, and how many people are flying in and how many people are renting cars. There's a lot of math involved in that, that I have not, been brave enough to tackle, for this particular event yet.
Let me know if you need any help. So the Sports Corp is a private entity. Is that right? It's not a government organization.
It's correct. It's technically a not-for-profit organization that serves as the city's tourism arm, sports tourism arm, much like Visit Indy, is the traditional tourism arm, for the city, but it's kind of its own not-for-profit entity that basically gets contracted to do that work.
And this is clearly like when we hear TKO executives speaking about where there are areas for growth, site fees routinely come up. And I think this would represent sort of their vision of where they want to be marketing these events, both the WWE and UFC, of going to different municipalities, different cities. And in this case, having a 8-year commitment. I'm very curious as well about if we see more involvement of the UFC end here. Like I'm amazed that just looking this up, UFC has held 2 events total in their history in Indianapolis. Like it's a very underserved part of the country when it comes to UFC that has just hit every single state that it's legalized in. And they're, you know, WWE, they have like a pretty, like it's a routine stop for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, over the course of the past 35, 40 years, WWE has hosted more than 100 events in Indianapolis, another 25 in other parts of the state. And as you mentioned, only 2 UFC events during the course of its existence. I've asked the Sports Corp and WWE about whether a broader TKO partnership could be on the table here. It sounds like they're open to it, but we don't have specifics of what that might look like at this point in time. I know, from my previous coverage of Sports Corp, when it comes to their announcements, they like to focus on what they're announcing at that time and kind of have that as a singular focus, especially with, Royal Rumble, an event Indianapolis has never had, mm-hmm. being just, 7 months away. So I'm sure that those conversations will probably come at some point in time, assuming that Royal Rumble itself goes well. Which I know, certainly all parties are interested in making that happen. But for the sake of this deal, I think that Royal Rumble getting this deal off to a good start is critical for what the future partnership looks like. So if that goes well, I think that we're probably going to see more opportunities for UFC and perhaps other events that enter the TKO fold over the next few years. Come to Indianapolis.
Yeah. I guess just to add something, it's not really a question, but I do see reporting and it makes sense around the Anaheim deal that WWE and UFC have done. It's a 5-year deal. And we've already had one edition of that with, John will remind me who the UFC fighter is. That's, who went longer than I think his intended take on an on-screen appearance. But yeah, this is obviously a much bigger deal, as cause it involves the biggest WWE events.
Yeah. Yes. Michael Chandler was our fighter who was supposed to be fighting next weekend, but will not be fighting Conor McGregor. He's in the wait and see approach. But Mickey, I want to thank you very much for jumping on and giving us some insight. This is, I think, going to just be the start of, I think, a very aggressive push by WWE, and they're going to be relying on these events getting off to a strong start so that they can shop them to international markets and domestically, because I think this is the future of where it's going, where you want a big time event, you're going to have to really give us a ton of incentive to come to your state for it. And we're seeing that right down to like television, like Raws and SmackDowns, that they want to be in that same bucket. So it's a very big part of TKO's growth strategy.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right. And where can everyone follow your work as well, Mickey, before we
leave? I'm on Twitter at Mickey Shuey, MickeySHuey, SHUEY. And, on the IBJ website, IBJ.com.
All right. Well, we thank you very much, Mickey. Thanks for stopping by. We appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks. Have a good one.
All right. That was Mickey Shuey joining us. And We will see. The first WrestleMania since the Hoosier Dome in 1992. Where do you remember what the big hook was? That Ric Flair was going to reveal photos of Elizabeth to the audience.
As a 7-year-old watching that, I was a little nervous. I do remember that WrestleMania well. That's like the peak of my childhood fandoms around 1992.
Yeah. It was also like the peak of their scandal that they were also going.
Yeah, which I was totally unaware of at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. As an 8-year-old, I was not really up on what I was watching and what was going on behind the scenes. That was for a teenage John Pollock to discover of this company I'd been following. But thanks again to Mickey for joining us. Momentarily, we're going to get to our David Bixenspan chat. But before we do that, Brandon, we had a tale of two. This is where the country divide is really emphasized between you and I, because in the U.S., SmackDown and Raw performed tremendously against the Stanley Cup final. But up here in Canada, SmackDown and Raw took a thrashing against the NHL.
Monday's, we had the same viewership I saw.
It was, but I mean, this was an unbelievable number that they did on Monday night. 7.55 million people watched the NHL game. And that's not accounting for TVA Sports, which is the French language broadcaster, I understand, also carried the game. So there were actually more that were watching it, but just taking 7.55 million and for the multiple to get the US equivalent would be around 9. So think about that. It's almost the equivalent of like a 68 or so million people in the US. If you want to just do that math, it's an insane number for sports in Canada. But SmackDown and Raw were both hurt pretty significantly, but not the case in the US. SmackDown did a great number on Friday. They were second for the night on television behind the NHL game. And then Monday's episode of Raw did another very strong number.
Yeah, this was basically for both Raw and SmackDown in the U.S., their highest numbers since post-WrestleMania episodes. To top it all off, though, your big rating in Canada was big, but the Edmonton Oilers falling short. I was rooting for the Oilers. It's hard to root for a hockey team from Florida. Watching there and in Florida with the palm trees around the arena and whatnot. Anyway, but it was a good rating. I mean, I don't want to go in depth on one rating, but a good rating for Raw and for SmackDown. And they both won against Game 6 and Game 7 respectively.
Yeah. So no more hockey and no more basketball for the foreseeable future. Last thing before we get to the interview, we got some Pole Star. Oh, we have Super Chat, so we will get to you as well before the interview. Polestar, we got some feedback or at least some data as it relates to Double or Nothing last month in Las Vegas. And what was it? It was in Las Vegas, correct?
It was Las Vegas.
MGM Grand
Arena. Yep.
That's where they were. So what did this tell us? It was about 9,000-ish paid and a gate of just north of $500,000.
$582,204, according to Polestar data. This is, the first thing I want to do is compare it to prior Double or Nothings. And we know that Hangman Page, according to CM Punk, jeopardized the $1 million gate. So that was a $1 million gate in 2022, right? But I did put out a whole list here in my report here, just showing you all the pay-per-view event gate numbers that I could find and that I remember and that I know of. So this is again, 582,000. Dynasty was 401,000. Revolution with the Sting retirement was over $1 million. So it's a good gate. $500,000 is a lot of money. It's more money than I have. But these are down from prior year's peaks. Of course, the record by far is All In last year, 10 million, according to AEW. You would assume that they're going to come, that they'll have the highest gate by far, at least in this year, is going to be All In. Who knows what the gate is at this point? I think the ticket prices are higher, but the attendance is almost certainly going to be lower this year.
And Forbidden Door is, last check from WrestleTix, approaching 9,000 at the UBS Arena on Long Island, New York. So we will see what the kind of last minute walk up is for Forbidden Door, which has traditionally been a very successful concept for the company going back. We only have two versions of it so far, but both years have been very successful. So there you have it. Super chat time. Let's go to the first one here from Jumanji Hunter himself. Should WBD run another AEW episode with a weaker prelim to see AEW's true value and demo. This person will not be the head of programming at any television network. But yeah, this will be quite the, let's tank a show to see what will our audience tune into. You know, I sat through WCW in 2000. I found out what the core audience would be if you gave them the worst possible programming.
Yeah, I'm scrambling to find a line chart that I want to share, but you're going to find, I think there is a question around, okay, what's the core popularity of AEW? What is it really if you don't give it the Big Bang Theory, which is a surprisingly and tremendously strong rerun program that does really good ratings. If you take that Big Bang Theory away, Dynamite does a lower average, right? And you get to compare it to things like NXT and say, oh, they're even closer, or NXT looks even better in that comparison. But ultimately, believe it or not, TV executives care about things other than wrestling programs, and they want to have the highest viewership that they can at all times. And AEW's viewership is, at least in the demo, is definitely elevated even above the Big Bang Theory level when AEW Dynamite is on.
Also, we didn't get into the Collision and Rampage numbers, but one observation to take out from that is that, as you have seen, you know, a lot of cable programming that has declined, like AEW just staying stagnant with Rampage resulted in Rampage being like 10th for the night on Friday, which, I mean, they're going to be for Rampage to rank 10th. I'm certainly they're happy with that. With a 0.12, a 0.12 is a lot more valuable today than it was 2 years ago, but that's kind of where cable is these days. And for a Friday night, 10 p.m. Eastern program, and you finish 10th, I think they take that as a victory.
Yeah, and I want to share this to give us some idea of where this show was, and what our super chat contributor here is referring to, is that the Black Panther, the film, was on before Dynamite this past Wednesday, as opposed to the Big Bang Theory, which is almost always the lead in. And the difference was really strong, really different. It was the last quarter hour, I believe, was doing a 0.17 when it was the Big Bang Theory, is doing a 0.06 for Black Panther. The thing I want to point out here for people watching in video is that you see the effect that Dynamite has for the network relative to the programs that are on before and after it. Now, keep in mind, though, in the case against AEW, that this is prime time, and this is the time when you would expect people to naturally turn on the TV and sit down on the couch in general. So it better be up. But this is also why you program strong things in there. But that aside, it at least does a lot better than the programs that are on before and after it. And if AEW Dynamite was really this week's show that was not really performing that well, its line, you'd not see such a bump here.
Okay, and we will go to one more super chat, and then David Bixon's band is coming up. From Pete in Texas, thank you for the super chat. What are Brandon's honest thoughts, only honest thoughts, on AEW since March and the quote-unquote new WWE with Triple H creative and leaf-fitting production since April?
Does Pete in Texas want like my content thoughts? I don't really have content thoughts. I think WWE is satisfying a lot more fans, and I gather that people like the production better. I don't have deep and intricate thoughts here. WWE's, and even before this past March, has been a better show for its audience, and the ratings have been up, particularly in the demo. NXT continues to be up in everything. Attendance continues to be strong. I don't have deep thoughts about Triple H creative or leaf-fitting production beyond that. I think, for me as a viewer, I could do without murder. If you want a sports-like presentation, I've learned, if you want to turn on the TV during prime time and then watch sports, sports-like presentation, you might as well just watch sports. And if you want to watch a horror show and be entertained and satisfied with a horror show, you might as well just watch a horror movie. That's sort of what I've concluded here in recent weeks. In AEW, I think it's all right. It's all right too. I think it needs a focus and a discipline in the content that I don't expect it to have. And I think it's going to, the gap and the disparity in at least the consumer metrics and the popularity of these two brands are going to be and continue to be about what they are. It's easier for me to believe that the gap will get wider than it will get narrower.
And on that note, we will now discuss World Championship Wrestling with David Bixenspan. And now we transition over to a topic that will never go away, and that is the demise of WCW on that fateful day in March of 2001. And here to end all the debate and give us a clear answer as to why WCW went out of business in three sentences or less is David Bixenspan joining us from Between the Sheets after we have just gone through four episodes of Who Killed WCW. Bix, as always, welcome back to the program. It's always great when we get to have you on the show.
Yes, thank you for having me. Cool. Is Never Go Away going to be the new like show you do with Way about WCW?
Go away. That's pretty good. That's
Never go away. Yes.
That could be true. Well, I can guarantee you that the legacies of WCW and ECW, ECW and WCW will long outlive the three of us, that I feel in 50 years will still be discussed, knowing, this fan base. But, so the timing of all this was like pretty surreal that out of nowhere, we get the news on Saturday that, Jamie Kellner, former head of Turner, who was installed in March of 2001, passes away at the age of 77. And this comes in the midst of, everyone looking forward, I think, to this fourth episode in terms of how the WCW sale was going to be covered by Vice. And you wrote a really great piece, and we'll link to that as well that people can read about. But for many people, like Jamie Kellner, if you're just following like his involvement here, it's kind of just reduced as, you know, this was the guy who made the ultimate call. But yourself, Chris Zellner, like you guys have done a lot of research and digging into Jamie Kellner and sort of his role in all of this. I just wanted you to kind of share a little bit about what compelled you to write this over the weekend, because there's plenty that I think is out there that goes a lot beyond just a one sentence summary of Jamie Kellner's involvement with WCW.
So I've been meaning to write something like this for a while and just didn't take the time to do it. But with Kellner's death and then it, you know, being a few days before the finale, I was like, okay, I need to just sit here on Saturday and just, you know, take an hour or two to write this and do this now. So, you know, the background here is, I should say, like, most of the stuff I'm citing is in the Nitro book. I want to give Guy Evans his full credit there. I do in the article, but still. But there was an additional, like, literal layer that Chris Zellner and I found. So when we were doing the Sale of WCW Patreon series at patreon.com/betweentheSheets, $5 tier or higher, as we were getting towards the end, okay, I don't remember if it was Chris search. He either was searching for like Jamie Kellner articles from around when he got the promotion, or he searched for Steve Heyer or Heyer, I forget how you pronounce it exactly, who was the outgoing president of Turner Broadcasting. And we didn't know much about him, but he was mentioned a couple times in The Torch and The Observer as being who's negotiating the sale for the Turner side with Fusion. And Chris finds this story from TV Week, which at the time was still, I believe, Electronic Media, but now is TV Week. And it's from right after Kellner got appointed and has a source they cite saying that Steve Heyer, whatever, I think it's Heyer, I think Bischoff says Heyer, had been trying to, in his words, he was telling people, quote unquote, kill Jamie. And that became interesting because, as Guy Evans revealed in his book from talking to Brian Bedall of Fugent, the reason that Jamie Kellner, it seemed, ended up actually deciding to cancel the WCW programming was that there had been a clause put into the Fusion deal that Fusion would have control of the time slots on the Turner networks that were allotted to Nitro and potentially Thunder for X amount of years, even if WCW ceased to exist. So knowing that the person who was negotiating the deal for Turner and put this very weird clause in there happily, and then he resigns as soon as Kellner is put in charge as his boss and had been telling people he was trying to like politically mess with Kellner. We felt like it was fairly clear that he put it in there as a poison pill. Either Kellner gets wise to it and kills WCW and by canceling the shows or whatever and ends up, you know, having that on his reputation or whatever. Or Kellner doesn't get wise to it and potentially it's considered a big problem that follows him around for his tenure at Turner. All of that's moot because Kellner left after 2 years regardless of, you know, and he did obviously cancel the shows. But yeah, reading Nitro, I was already of the opinion that I felt like Jamie Kellner was getting a bad rap because here it's not even just Kellner. It's Brian Bedall saying, like, look, we put this clause in here and they were probably right to call it out as a red flag. But when you know that the person who let them put it in there had it in for Jamie Kellner, I think that makes it even more kind of forgivable that, like, yes, ideally do I wish that he had gone to Fusion and said, look, I'd like to keep the shows, but I can't let you have this clause. Sure. But I also don't blame him for just throwing his hands up and being like, okay, screw it. I'm done with this. I'm washing my hands of this. I'm canceling these shows.
Because yeah, it's not like it would necessarily be impossible to change that deal to just modify the contract, right?
In theory, I would think, you know, especially since, you know, as then comes out, you know, months later in Multichannel News in the article that I have linked in the article that John read on the show with Way last night, like they had already modified the offer a bit in terms of the financial terms and stuff, which is something that's rarely talked about. Like when I found that article, like I, as best as I could tell, like none of the wrestling newsletters covered it. They're like, and it even kind of obliquely mentions the time slot guarantee, although it doesn't mention the even if WCW ceased to exist part. So like you would think they could have changed it if the deal's already changing. But like I said, I don't blame him for just being like, okay, screw it. This is ridiculous.
And it also begs the question of like, yeah, in theory, like, does this have to kill the company to go to Brian Bedall? Will you guys eliminate this clause? And if you're Brian Bedall, like, how are you responding to that thought that we're going to invest whatever the actual exposure they were going to have in terms of buying this company? If they can just lose these time slots at a whim, that 6 months in they could lose these slots, are they as committed to buying this company that we knew was going to be, like, it was so contingent on these time slots? And I don't know if it's just an automatic yes that they would have eliminated that clause.
Yes, but also, like, would they have been willing to do a guarantee of X years as long as WCW exists? Like, at least reading Nitro, I kind of got the impression that it wasn't strictly the time slot guarantee. It was the even if there's no longer WCW part that Turner and Kellner and those people just did not want to go forward with. So it's a question mark, but I think I gotta think there was some that if you're going to make the deal, there's going to be some kind of guarantee that you're going to have a contract for X number of years just for the TV show. Like I think that would be natural. So I think it was specifically the if WCW happens to cease to exist during the term of the contract thing that really bothered them, because then you've completely given up this programming real estate, the beachfront property, as Eric Bischoff called it, to Fusion to do what with? You don't know, because there's no WCW in that scenario.
And one of the keys here is that, as you point out in the article, is that Steve Heyer was on his way out of the company. It says here, from you're quoting from one of the trades here, the next day he was going to Coca-Cola.
Yes, he had already planned his exit before.
And he's political enemy, supposedly, of Jamie Kellner.
Yes, although it's not super clear why that was, other than my assumption would be that he expected to get the position Kellner got, I guess. But that's not stated in the article, but that's my assumption, like, because they don't lay it out. They just lay out that he was really gunning for it.
So in terms of episode 4, I mean, there were such expectations for what different directions they could go in, and Like, I honestly believe you could get multiple episodes just out of this entire process and really digging into things. How did you feel the sale was covered in episode 4 and just the good and the bad of the episode from your impressions?
I think, you know, I don't know, obviously, how they had the episode laid out before they got that Last Nitro documentary footage. But I feel like without that, you probably have a lot more room to talk about the sale process. And I mean, the big omission for me, and I'm someone who understood to a point why they didn't include a Dave Meltzer or Wade Keller or someone or Brian Alvarez or anyone else who covered it at the time, just because you already have Guy Evans. And sometimes someone who has more time and distance and wasn't covering it at the time actually is better for that kind of historian type role. But in episode 4, you badly needed a Dave Meltzer to come in and say, when they're talking about all the Stu Snyder stuff, wait a second. Someone called me the day of the Fusion announcement and said that Stu Snyder told them and was telling everyone in WWF that Eric Bischoff and Fusion are never getting WCW.
Yeah.
That's the big red flag. It's not necessarily, oh, Stu Snyder and Brad Siegel were fraternity brothers, which, if that is true, was not actually mentioned in the episode, just they had known each other most of their adult lives. But it's not necessarily that. That's just kind of the first link, and then it's like, oh, okay, Stu Snyder was telling people he knew something.
Yeah. And listening to John's interview the other day with Evan Husney, he brought up the notion of whether they were going to include, you know, the newsletter writers of the time. And he said it was hard for them, the newsletter voices, to be objective now. And I guess he's probably referring to the animosity on Twitter that we often see between Dave Meltzer and Eric Bischoff, and just the notion that, I guess, my takeaway was that in Evan's mind, that Dave couldn't be fair in this situation.
I guess, but it doesn't have to be Dave either. I mean, well, that's another thing. Wade and or even Jason Powell, who, you know, Eric praises. Eric is fine with them. So you wouldn't have that issue with them, and it doesn't seem like they have, like, any excess heat with other people who would be necessary.
I wouldn't take, like, an oppositional view to Eric Bischoff as being disqualifying either.
Right. Yes, of course. I did find that comment from Evan a little weird, though, because it is kind of dancing around the fact that, and I don't say this as a slight to Guy did follow up Nitro by writing Eric's second book with him. So I did find that specific comment a little weird. I think it's fine to have Guy in there as the expert. I don't even think you need to say he wrote Eric's second book with him, but I don't quite get giving that reason to exclude Dave or someone like Dave while including Guy and not mentioning that about Guy.
So Bix, where do you stand on some of the comments I've been reading this morning on Twitter in reaction to this episode, that this was a Eric Bischoff tribute piece?
I think people are just overreacting to, like, the last couple minutes of episodes 2 and 4.
As soon as you got that waterfront scenic shot with Eric Bischoff, I think that was, you know, he got the real hero's farewell. But to be quite honest, like, I feel of the people that you are looking in here as people that contributed to the demise of this company, whether it's Kevin Nash or Vince Russo or Eric Bischoff or Brad Siegel, like, I think Bischoff had, like, a fairly good accounting of himself. There's definitely criticisms I can have of him in these 4 episodes. But in terms of someone that was at least willing to assume some blame, like, he's one of the few that does cop to, like, bad decisions that were made on his watch, which is a lot more than I can say about a Nash or a Russo in this series.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, Eric has a lot of faults, but, like, if you're looking at him in the lens of these episodes, he admits fault, he takes responsibility, he does look at various things in hindsight and say, okay, yes, that was a terrible idea. The only one where he doesn't really, like, kind of acknowledge, okay, that was a bad idea, was David Arquette, but even then he still took complete responsibility for it. You know, he talks about how burnt out he was towards the end of his run running the company, which is a thing other people around him have talked about for years, and how that was affecting him and affecting the company. Like, you know, and you know, like you talked about on the shows John, with Evan, like, he's more up, or maybe it was Evan that said it, that he's more upfront and like in, about some things and just like admitting, oh, yes, of course, the NWO were supposed to be implied WWF invaders. Like, he, it's a, it was a different Eric from the guy who's doing the shtick on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, that Eric will take responsibility for stuff. So I think it's mainly just like the big hero shots at the end of those episodes. But also, like, let's be realistic. Of the people you could point the finger at, Eric Bischoff did not kill WCW. Eric Bischoff was not in charge of the company past September 1999. And yes, he had some creative input in 2000. But as far as him actually being the person in charge, WCW was completely salvageable when he got demoted, sent home, whatever. Things had gotten a lot worse with the Nash booking and everything, which I agree with what John and Wei said about how that really should have gotten probably a little more time because of just how bad the TV was and just how much it was affecting business.
This is the image I wanted on just one episode. Just give me 5 seconds of this, like some charts of that 1999 period from January to September. And I think it would have been pretty illuminating for people that, like, again, you could, this whole series is about going in all these different directions where you can look at the problems from the top of Turner to the day-to-day operations of the company. And there's fault to be placed across, but it is almost as though we had like this faction of, listen, this was completely out of our control versus others that would look at strictly the creative decisions. And it's just not that simple of an answer, but there's absolutely. And that was kind of my takeaway with Kevin Nash, who was just like, listen, it was, there was nothing we could do about this. Absolutely nothing. And like I think Nash came off probably the worst in this whole series. And I think he could have come across so much more worse if you really dived into the period that this company nosedives and you see these declines of the business they were doing in 1999. That was still, as Bix mentions, like extremely salvageable by September 99 when Bischoff is sent home for the first time.
Yeah. And one thing that, I mean, we should mention too, that, you know, whenever this error comes up on Between the Sheets, we try to stress, but it got talked about somewhat in the show, but really not necessarily in the context it should have. Yes, in 1998, they were the highest grossing wrestling company ever to exist up to that point for a calendar year. What they don't talk about, though, too, is like, you know, yes, WWF's getting stronger again. In 1998, it's not a WWF boom, it's not a WCW boom, it's a wrestling boom.
Totally.
Like, I feel like that barely gets talked about now. Like,
WCW did 3 stadium nitros in December.
December alone.
Astrodome, TWA Dome, and then that January 4th Georgia Dome show. That's a 4-week period, and they do 3 stadium nitros on top of a Starcade pay-per-view that was, you know, very successful number with Goldberg and Nash. That's all in a 4-week period at a time when you're painting WCW under this, like, doom and gloom period. Like, they did extraordinary business through the first quarter, second quarter of 99. They're still doing very good business on pay-per-view.
Yes, and with the finger poke of doom too. The finger poke of doom, while obviously terrible booking, that's not what caused business to go down. And even with the famous thing about viewers changing the channel, you know, when Schiavone at Bischoff's direction spoils the title change, which, big mistake, because normally, you know, they hadn't done in years, but when Eric would spoil stuff on Raw, it was always, oh, you can just skip this, you know, this, nothing important's happening, this person's retaining the title, etc. This time he was telling you, oh, something big is happening. But all those viewers came back.
Finger Poke of Doom has its own Wikipedia page. Go on, Vix.
But all of those viewers and more came back for the end of the show. Like, that's the thing that never gets talked about. Like, yes, they did tune out to Raw, but once Raw was off and that Nitro had the overrun and everything, they all came back. They all came back to watch the whole thing that turned out to be the finger poke. But yeah, as far as
they came back to see Goldberg bust out of prison and make his way across the street and then get laid out at the end of the show. But yeah, there is the big tune back factor. But yes, that was the show long story of Goldberg. What's he being accused of? Sexual assault or stalking?
No, stalking. It was originally going to be that he sexually assaulted Elizabeth. Goldberg refused to do it. And then it became aggravated stalking.
Aggravated stalking. So yes, that was that was the handling of their big draw on January the 4th. You know, obviously, like you're.
Oh, I realized I didn't finish the thought though. Just about so the
go ahead.
The actual business drop is from the lack of follow up that Goldberg is not getting comeuppance or in a feud with the NWO really in any big way. You know, not. I mean, he has the Scott Hall thing for a few weeks, but that's about it. And really, then the downturn really starts with the Flair Hogan double turn, where the show that it happened on did a great number, but then it clearly wasn't what people wanted. And that's when business starts going down. And then Nash is the booker, and you have him and Randy Savage dumping poop on each other. And you get the idea.
Contortionists coming out of gym bags. I mean, this was all the stuff you might have missed in 1999.
Well, to be clear, a contortionist in a gym bag, escaping the gym bag, and then dumping a bucket of poop on Randy Savage.
That's right. Yeah, that was their go-home angle, as I recall, for their big pay-per-view match. Brandon, you just watched this episode this morning. I mean, kind of watching it with fresh eyes. I mean, how did you feel? You know, who came off well in the episode, and did you feel they were able to convey like an understandable story to people that are just tuning in with kind of the bare facts about how WCW went out of business?
I'm glad that they introduced the idea and they presented it sort of as a conspiracy theory, but Eric Bischoff gives it some credit. The idea that Stu Schneider and Brad Siegel had some kind of like backroom agreement that led to WCW being bought by WWF. It would have been nice to, I guess, as a reporter, I have some bias about not including people like that, although, you know, they did include Guy Evans. But yeah, it seemed like a coherent story. I can see how people did feel that it was, you know, a tribute to Eric Bischoff. But I was impressed that Booker T did lay the blame on Eric Bischoff. You know, they sort of, you know, have this closing montage of asking people directly who killed WCW. And Booker T, who you know, often says things that I would disagree with, puts it right on Eric Bischoff.
And Booker T, who also did have some severe wrestler brain during that episode.
Yes, you know, showed up at the final Nitro, and it was just another Monday, and nobody knew anything days after this announcement had been made. But yeah,
yes,
issues like that with people's memories and the way that people, we have this notion that, well, this person was there, so they know everything firsthand, and that's really important to include people who were there firsthand. But there are often cases, and Bix will remind us what they are, of where people have bad memories, or they're stretching the truth. They're telling Hulk Hogan stories here, and they just don't know their own stories as well as some historians actually do.
Yes. I mean, a great example, and it ties into, you know, the sister shows of this. Jonathan Coachman's reaction to the Plane Ride from Hell episode of Dark Side of the Ring, which I should give the disclaimer, I worked on the first half of the season. The non-Canadian budget was getting depleted before the second half. I did not work on that episode. People on Reddit who blame me for that episode, I did not work on that episode. I'm not in the credits. Anyway. So, as some people might remember, in the days after the Plane Ride from Hell episode aired, Jonathan Coachman goes on Twitter and he tells a story. And I want to be clear too, he had told the story before. I don't remember where, if it was on one of, you know, a radio show or a podcast, whatever. He had told the story before, and as we'll get into more, and the reason I bring it up, he seemed to genuinely believe it. He tells this whole story about how Heidi Doyle and the other flight attendant are full of shit, how he was the star witness in the trial, It was in the Eastern District of New York in Brooklyn. He remembers staying at the Waldorf Astoria, you know, before he testified, and how his testimony was so important that he won the case for WWE. Here's the problem with that. The lawsuit was filed in county court in Arizona, was quickly moved to federal court in Arizona, and overall was settled by WWE in a little over a month. There was no discovery, so no depositions. There was no trial, so there was no testifying in court. And none of this would have happened in New York. And Coach uncharacteristically apologized when I showed all of this to him. I don't know if it's bad brain. I don't know if it's that there was another lawsuit we don't know about another charter flight, which I don't think is out of the question. But he seemed to genuinely believe that, and to his credit, when confronted with incontrovertible evidence, he didn't explain what he was getting it confused with, but he deleted the tweets and he publicly apologized. I don't think Booker is even necessarily deliberately bullshitting about the WWF, you know, purchase, not knowing about it.
I didn't think that either. I think it was just poor memory. Like, that was it.
Yeah, like, now, I think there's a question of, do you include that in the episode? Like,
fair,
They were clear enough about the sale having already been announced that I think you do a good enough job to leave it up to the viewer to be like, hey, wait a second. But there's also the question of what value does it have? Too, because it wasn't really put in there to frame Booker T as inaccurate or lying or anything. So,
and that's a pattern we see of like these, like the Dark Side episodes in here. Like, I just from watching, like, they have not implicitly stated this, but you do feel as though they like to present here are the competing narratives, here are the stories, and we're not going to have that reporter necessarily as the referee to determine what actually happened or not. They're putting that on you, the viewer, to take these competing stories and you kind of make your own judgments. It's not the way I would go about it, but you know, we've had several stories where you just get these, you know, theories that are presented and people that are all over the place. Maybe the peak of this was that Montreal episode in season one.
I was going to say the Matt Bourne episode.
The Matt Bourne more recently, where they introduced the whole conspiracy theory at the end of the show. It takes this weird left turn. And yeah, sometimes I think you do want that person that is, you know, that covered this, that can give you like a clean timeline of the events going on here, but that's not always been their philosophy.
Yeah, and again, they are the most successful show on the network, but it's like they don't have a huge budget. You do have to carefully consider with travel and everything, who are you interviewing for a given episode? I mean, that's different from this in Dark Side, where you know you're stretching the interviews across the four episodes. But that, I mean, it is legitimately a factor. Like, Evan is not bullshitting when he says that. Like, that is a huge part of it. So, I mean, and also I think there's the question of, like, is of the people that they interviewed, that we saw the interviews of, is there really anyone where you, weighing the factors ahead of time, would have cut that interview in favor of Dave Meltzer or Wade Keller or Jason Powell or Brian Alvarez? And I don't think you can say there is anyone that's that clear cut. You know, like, the wrestlers are people, you know, who were fairly prominent and have their own reasons to be there. You know, the behind-the-scenes people certainly have unique roles in why you would interview them, even if some were used more than others. But I don't think there's anyone that was like an obvious, oh, you could just, you know, cut this interview out completely and, you know, that's someone you could have cut out completely to make room in the budget and the schedule for like Dave Meltzer or whoever.
I want to get your thought on just how, you know, for people going in here, they were most curious about hearing the from Stu Snyder opposite Brad Siegel in this episode. I don't think it's going to quell anyone that came in with their theories on if anything underhanded went onward, but. Did you feel it gave any more clarity hearing from them and how they approached that side of things? Like, we didn't get into like the Jerry Jarrett group that was, you know, attempting to buy this or any of the other potential buyers of this. They kind of focus squarely on Fusion and then WWF coming in and swooping it under. But how did you feel that portion of the episode was handled?
It's one of those things where I think, like, yeah, I think you really needed more than one episode to discuss the sale process, mm-hmm. because then you can talk about the other suitors. Then you can give more time to explain, like, what exactly the Fusion deal was. And you have more room to kind of and then explain, like, yeah, like, again, the conspiracy theory isn't just fraternity brothers and Stu Snyder told colleagues this and that. It's that there were other people who had expressed interest with good faith offers. So, yeah, like, do I get why in the episode they were doing with the amount of time they had, they didn't mention most of those? Yes. But I do wish they had more time, because it's like, unfortunately, it doesn't give you a complete picture. Because, yeah, why, okay, this is what the things were with Fusion at that point. Why don't you go to the Jerry Jarrett, J.J. Dillon, Lenita Erickson, oh, I'm blanking on who their money guy was, that group? Like, why don't you turn to, you know, Bob Marwitz, who certainly has the funding? I'm not sure what I make of the Jeff Blatnick-led group that Dave Meltzer's brought up recently. I think Dave has said at one point that Cablevision was in the running and looking at buying it. Randy Savage may have been trying to buy it. Like, there were other people who had investors and money who could have done it. So, you know, and especially, you know, someone like Bob Marwitz, who does live events and production and everything, you know, like, why, you know, and is a legend in broadcasting, you know, with, you know, his radio days and stuff. Like, why are you not going back to any of these? And I think, even if it wasn't like a big conspiracy, at the end of the day, do I think that, like, there was some part of Brad Siegel that was like, if this gets too hairy or annoying or whatever, I'm just making the deal with Stu and we're getting the TV show canceled or something like that? Yeah. Something we need to talk about that we haven't yet. Brad Siegel backing up the Jamie Kellner hated wrestling narrative.
Right. So we have that had always been like the characterization of Jamie Kellner, which I guess originated from Jim Barnett making observation.
Talking to Dave Meltzer. Yeah.
To Dave Meltzer. And that was sort of how it was painted, that Kellner was not a fan of professional wrestling. And yeah, Brad Siegel kind of backs that up. And to my knowledge, like, Kellner's only interview he's done on wrestling was in the Guy Evans book. And in that book, he states he was a professional wrestling fan when he grew up. And he states in the book that this was just a numbers decision that it came down to. But yeah, you did have Siegel here, someone that would have been around Jamie Kellner, who, I mean, did paint that picture of him.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the truth's somewhere in the middle. You know, maybe the idea he hated wrestling is exaggerated, but maybe as a broadcasting executive, he felt that that wrestling was not tenable at that time, with, you know, in terms of ad rates and the image of the network and the rebranding and everything, which that's something we should mention too. You know, they mentioned the rebranding of TBS and TNT in passing and how that was a factor, because it's right around when Kellner takes over and they cancel wrestling that we get the TNT for drama, TBS for comedy split. AEW makes their deal with what's now Warner Brothers Discovery, but at the time was still the Turner Networks at Warner, basically right as that is gotten rid of, which I never see anyone else talk about, really. Like, wrestling went away when they changed the format, and when they undid that, you know, almost two decades later, all of a sudden wrestling's back.
Well, they made a bid, I think, according to Tony Khan. Kevin Riley was interested in SmackDown, right? And they bid something over $100 million for SmackDown in the cycle where it goes to Fox. So presumably they were interested in wrestling enough to make a bid at that time.
Yes. And also, one of the things Jamie Kellner talks about as far as the idea he hated wrestling, like, he said something about having tried to make a deal with WWF when he was at Fox, which I'm guessing refers to how they had a couple of Saturday Night's Main Event specials on Fox at the end of 92. So I don't know where I sit on that. I think it, like I said, I'm guessing it's somewhere in the middle where he didn't hate wrestling the way that everyone's always said, but it was more, he was willing to look at the negatives on the business side of it. But I don't know. I mean, I'm also not sure exactly how much I trust Brad Siegel, because he has come off shifty at times in the interviews on Who Killed WCW.
And I guess if Jamie Kellner felt like he had to get rid of this contract because of the guarantee of the time slot, he did at least do that one interview for the Guy Evans book, but he didn't mention that, didn't bring that up, right, in any part of
it. I believe so, yeah. From when I was rereading it the other night, it was mainly from Bedal that whole thing was in there. But, I mean, it's possible Kellner said something similar and Guy just didn't include the quote because Bedal had the better memory of it and was, you know, recounting it in detail.
If you, Bix, were to get the go-ahead that, hey, we're going to do a episode 5 epilogue episode, and we get 5 new names that you would most want to hear from that have not been represented in the series already. Who would be the 5 people you would, that obviously are living now, excluding now Jamie Kellner, that would have added to the series if you were to do a follow-up episode on the sale that were left out?
Not counting the reporters or including the reporters?
Anyone. Yeah, we can include reporters too. They can make out your 5.
So this gets tricky because even though you want Dave because of that Stu Snyder thing, Wade actually did a much better job covering the sale at the time. Like, if you look back through that coverage, as we did on Between the Sheets Patreon, which I actually should mention, I haven't done it yet, but we decided we are going to make one of those shows free. I don't know if that'll be done yet by the time this goes up, but people just keep an eye on the feed and on the Patreon. But yes, that's the one that we're going to make free. I lost my train of thought. Where was I going with that?
Well, you mentioned like having, we'll schedule like one of those slots for, you do have your reporter, whether it be
yes. So yes, Wade had a lot more about the deal potentially falling apart than Dave did. So you kind of like, I feel like if you have one, or especially at least if you have Dave, you kind of have to have Wade. But I would want Dave in there because of the Stu Snyder thing. So that's 2. As far as within WCW, I mean, if we're expanding to AEW people that we think were not in this because it was a $7 thing, Tony Schiavone. And then, like, I mean, we've got a lot, like, we had a lot of the people you would want in there from the inside, like a Janie Engel who never really does interviews. So, like, is there anyone else? You know, we have most of the people who were of note in Nitro. Any other, like, wrestlers?
Do you think Lenita Erickson would have been someone of
interest to talk about the competing? That's a good one. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And especially Jerry Jarrett's gone. JJ Dillon's not in good health. She would be the person to talk to about it. Okay. So that's 4. And then I would say just anyone you could find from one of the other, you know, potential buyer groups would be 5.
Yeah, maybe a Brian Bedal you throw in there.
Yes, actually, or even just Brian Bedal. Like, I was actually a little surprised he wasn't in there.
Yeah, I mean, not the, I guess, easiest guy to track down, as I've been trying. But maybe he will pop up in one of these post-mortem WCW episodes. But overall, I think it was a series that I don't think it was necessarily breaking a ton of new ground, but I think a lot of people are now more, that checked out the series, are a lot more aware of kind of the below the surface type of maneuverings that were going on in WCW, and whether it leads them to the Nitro book, whether it leads them to the 2-part WCW sale drama available at BetweenTheSheetsPod.com, potential free episode.
Well, Patreon.com/BetweenTheSheets. Well, remember, no, it's actually technically 4 parts. We did the 2-part sale of WCW first, and then later we realized, oh, wait, there was a lot of stuff in 2000 we should have done, because this was all about Fusion, and we did another 2 parts about the 2000 talks of the sales with WWF buying and stuff, which is, that's something else I wish they had gotten into more. The original WWF attempt at buying WCW circa like September, October, 2000. Cause that like really, they only talked about in passing. It's an interesting story because, you know, I think John, you talked about it on one of the shows with Way that, actually, no, or was it you or was it one of the shows Jack and Carnassia did? There was something, one of you talked about how Wade Keller caught up with Vince at the XFL press conference about Jesse Ventura being an XFL announcer, because that was in the Twin Cities. And how Vince on the record is explaining they had a deal with TNN where they were going to pay a certain amount of money to buy out Viacom's exclusivity on WWF cable programming that Vince felt was worth it. And, you know, was it in the, you know, single digit millions? Was it more? Who knows? Vince's claim was that TNN then changed their mind and that's why the deal died. That they upped the number to the point it didn't make sense. So that's why WWF pulled out. So there's that, you know, that's something I really would have liked to have seen get touched on. Like, that's somewhere where, like, a Jim Ross would have been great, because at least what was in the newsletters at the time was that if they had brought WCW then and had the Turner Network slots, that Jim Ross would have been the one put in charge of WCW. So, like, that's something. I mean, you could probably do a whole episode about that. That's something that I really would have liked to have been touched on. Maybe that's something that, you know, once Jim's feeling better, then maybe he and Conrad could talk about on their show. But yeah, like there is, six episodes definitely would have fleshed it out more. But I can also see why, like, when you're trying to sell the network on it, you say four. Because six episodes is basically, you know, like, that's the same, like, length as that, you know, the half seasons of that long third season of Dark Side of the Ring.
Yeah. I think that certainly it was like the sale in and of itself. It was going to be a real big kind of monster to tackle for episode four. But we've kept you very long here, Bix, so we want to thank you for jumping on board. Let's give you the floor for what is coming up on Between the Sheets. And again, another plug where people can go check out a lot more, as you and Chris did, extensive deep dives into the demise of WCW. Plus, the racial discrimination lawsuit is another series that you guys went into, which, I mean, they could get another four-parter just out of that one.
Yeah. So where do I start? Okay, main show, Between the Sheets. You can check out wherever podcasts are found, as well as betweentheSheetsPod.com. I don't have it in front of me. What show did we put out on Monday? Because I have the one we're in the process of recording on my mind.
2014.
Okay.
Yes. A patron request, 2014, which it was very weird to look back at some of this stuff being 10 years ago already. As I lost what tab I had you guys in as I was trying to find something. but where was I? There we go. So that, you know, that's this coming Monday is going to be. So wait, what were we doing this week? This coming Monday is going to be 1993. Which is a very interesting show because it's the week where the WWF magazine announcing their series of hit pieces against their enemies is announced. I mean, where the issue announcing that hits subscribers, mailboxes, and then also is the week that Mike Mooneyham runs the second part of his interview with Linda McMahon, where she talks about the pending lawsuits against the company, including going scorched earth against Tom Cole and everything that led to. So that's a lot that's there. So yeah, there's that. And then the week after, we'll mention, you know, we're going to have Daniel McCabe on talking 1999, and that will come out the week of his retirement match at SCI against Kevin Koo. So that's coming up on the regular main show, patreon.com/betweentheSheets. I mean, like I said, you know, not necessarily by the time this is up, but within the day, I'll have that one WCW show both unlocked on the Patreon and uploaded to the main feed, so people can check that out. But yeah, patreon.com/betweentheSheets, $5 a month tier or higher gets you access to our monthly deep dives on, you know, single topics instead of covering a week in history. You know, like we just talked about, we've done four parts on all the WCW sale stuff. We did two parts on the racial discrimination lawsuits last year. And there's a lot of WCW stuff in there that we made sure to have a separate category for. We just did three parts on Rob Feinstein's ouster from Ring of Honor. So good. That's among the more recent things we've done. And what we're, what we just finished recording this week and should be out any day now, part one of two on Eddie Gilbert's run with WCW from 88 to 90. And John, you'll never guess who becomes a prominent character on that show.
Oh my goodness. Is it our, you know, a cult hit is the one and only Paul Heyman in Between the Sheets lore that I hope we get many appearances of in these upcoming episodes from yourself.
Yes, because his firing for throwing a trash can at Ric Flair, although that's not reported exactly as the reason at the time, occurs in the middle of all this. And then there's the whole weird story in the newsletters of, are Paul E. Dangerously and Eddie Gilbert forming an independent wrestling consortium? Is this going to go public? Are there going to be stock options?
It will be a public company allowing for the fan base to truly revolutionize the 90s industry that is greatly in need of a shot in the arm that only myself and people like Edward Gilbert can possibly bring to the fan base.
You mean Thomas Edward Gilbert Jr., professionally known as Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert. And yes, in the last segment, I will not give full details now, but there may or may not be a letter from someone who sounds suspiciously like this, sir, but is not signed by the person you think it is, and they may even claim to be from another country or an existing... or an existing letter writer to this fine publication.
If that doesn't sell you on these upcoming shows, nothing will, everybody. So tune into that, the deep
dive. Well, and also, you know, we also have, you know, we did the ECW on TNN shows and the Death of ECW shows, eight parts total. That includes the whole thing of Paul Heyman sending a very obvious anonymous email to Wade Keller that's run in the Torch. And also...
Is this the one about the payments around Christmas time? That's the
letter. No, that was on the record.
That was an on-the-record one from Hay. Yeah, this was about payments being late and him explaining when the banks open up.
Yes, as a member of the Hebrew tribe, I may not be well-versed as the vaunted journalist of the Torch in the chronology of the Christmas holiday.
He's
which
not
is
exactly.
Basically what he said, yes.
Yes,
like, not 100% word for word, but about 90%. But I mean, that's in there too, but also, what Wade wrote on the Torch website and that Dave backed up about how, the belief was that, the ECW invasion came about because Paul, used a bunch of burner emails to, send, letters to wrestling websites talking about how the invasion needed, ECW to be injected into it. Which, funnily enough, Eddie Gilbert, as we learned years after his death, would go on CompuServe under an assumed name while booking Global to solicit feedback on Global. So make of that what you would like as far as the connections there. But yes, patreon.com/betweentheSheets. The Patreon now has been going on for almost 8 years. So 8 years worth of long monthly deep dives in there, lots of WCW stuff, lots of Paul and Eddie stuff, you know, multiple ROH shows. We did the Joel Goodhart show. Oh, personal favorites, the Main Event Championship Wrestling, John Collins shows with Bo James, which includes, if anyone ever wants to hear it, an amazing, what ends up being like a 30, 40 minute interlude of Bo explaining how to promote towns locally as a wrestling promoter. But all that's at patreon.com/betweentheSheets, $5 tier. Or higher, if you want to do an annual subscription, those are all 16% off the monthly price. So $50-$40 a year if you want to do the $5 tier. Patreon.com/betweentheSheets. And both of you are longtime loyal patrons, which I thank you for.
Yeah, there you go. We put our money where our mouth is. That is going to wrap up this week's edition of Pollock and Thurston. So I want to thank Mr. David Bixenspan, as well as Mickey Shuey from the Indiana Business Journal for stopping by over the past hour or so. Coming up this week, Brandon will be live at 11 a.m. Eastern time on WrestleNomics. Yes. It is the last Sunday of the month. So yes. are you going early before Forbidden Door on Sunday?
You always reveal these things to me.
I know. I'm just throwing
Forbidden
things
Door
out at you.
Sunday, isn't it?
Sunday.
It is Sunday to be determined.
Okay. Well, look out for that, everybody. We will have a review of the show late Sunday night, whatever time Forbidden Door concludes. So taking us into the early hours of Monday. So check out WrestleNomics.com, PostWrestling.com, and we will chat with you all next week, same time, same place, here on the Post Wrestling and WrestleNomics outlets.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.